This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In 2020, the Arctic was hotter than ever. People in Siberia were out in t-shirts when there should have been snow. It was crazy stuff there, and in the Canadian High Arctic, too. That changes weather and climate for all of us. It's not like Las Vegas, where what happens there stays there. This is going to affect us all right around the world. So join me as we investigate that and a whole lot more breaking news and science you may have missed with our friendly Canadian scientist Paul Beckwith. Paul taught climate science at the University of Ottawa, and he is now, in my opinion, the single largest source of climate videos on YouTube. Paul Beckwith, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex. It's always a pleasure to chat with you.
So before we get to those problems that really threaten the future of mankind, no doubt about it, how is the COVID-19 pandemic unfolding in eastern Canada where you live?
Well, Ottawa is doing relatively well compared to the larger places like Toronto and Montreal. But, you know, we are, I guess, in zone red, they call it. You know, the hospitals here, I think it all depends on the busyness at the in the intensive care unit at the hospitals in the particular region. So on that aspect, Ottawa is doing fairly well. You know, the messaging could be better from governments. I mean, the key thing is, yeah, masks are great. You know, wear masks indoors for sure. But if you're in a stuffy room with very poor ventilation and lots of other people inside, you can still easily catch the virus. I mean, the key thing is ventilation of indoor rooms. You need windows open. You need some cross flow, you know, even throughout the winter to not have the virus circulate in those conditions.
Yes, I live in a very small village, and when I go to our local pharmacy, there is no ventilation whatsoever. They probably have a heating system, but that's it. And, you know, people who are sick are going there for medications, and I don't feel comfortable picking up my stuff there if I need a prescription. So I go to the back door, and he hands it out the back door, and we're both wearing masks. It really hasn't sorted itself out well here. And yet, as you say, we're lower in British Columbia by far than in Washington State or Idaho, any of those places. But it's going up all the time. Our ICU numbers are going up all the time. And Alberta, right next door, is running out of control there. They have asked the federal government of Canada to come in and build field hospitals. They've asked the Red Cross to come in and build field hospitals. And yet they still have people going to bars and drinking, and the conservative government there has not put in a mask mandate. So it's just a machine like in the United States for producing disease, in my opinion.
Yeah, and I mean, the U.S. is going to be at 3,000 deaths a day very soon, which is basically, you know, 9/11 every single day for probably January, February, and March, the way it's going. And, you know, a connection to climate change, there is a way to check very easily the stuffiness level or ventilation level of any indoor room, and that's with a CO2 monitor. You can get inexpensive carbon dioxide monitors for about $100. And if one of those is in a school room or in a store or whatever, as long as the CO2 level is not much higher than the outdoor level, which is, we know, is about 415 parts per million or so, you know, as long as it's sort of below the 1,000 level or 800, 900, 700 level inside the room, you know that there's enough ventilation that there won't be any virus circulating in there. You know, if you go in a closed room and there's lots of people there, that level of CO2 can easily go up to 2,000, 3,000 parts per million, and you know there's insufficient ventilation. And if one of those people in that room has the virus, it doesn't matter who's wearing masks or whatever, everybody can catch it. I mean, that's so, you know, the government, if they were smart, they would mandate, they would get mass supplies of these CO2 monitors, put them indoors and say levels have to be below a certain level for people to be in there, even with masks.
Well, I guess if we didn't have a vaccine right around the corner, we would get those kind of meters and hang them around our necks with a little alarm that goes off and says, time to get out of here.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, as far as the vaccine, you know, hopefully we have an orderly distribution of it. You know, in the U.S., I'm not so sure. These things are shipped in large quantities to hospitals. You might have crowds of people scrambling to try to get vaccinated before everybody else. I don't know. But, you know, probably not, because a lot of people that might want to do that, you know, they don't believe the virus is real anyway. If they listen to 45 minutes of Trump, for example, spewing on with, you know, all of his lies. And it's a crazy country.
Well, it's a crazy country in a backdrop of a crazy world at the moment, and that extends right into the biology and the physics of what's going on. So let's get to the Arctic. This is a big one, and you've been an Arctic watcher for as long as I've known you, for over a decade that I've known you. So tell us what happened with the weather up in the Arctic this past year.
Well, the big question is, with the sea ice minimum in September, we blew away previous records in 2012, and there was a large cyclone which kind of tore apart the ice in that year. But before then, we'd set a record in 2007, which was a record for that time, and in 2005, and in 2003. Now, since 2012, of course, you know, we've set temperature records like crazy, and the Arctic's been warm. So the big question is, Why haven't we set additional records since then? And there was a very interesting paper with Jennifer Francis and Chinese colleague, and they basically related the, they say that, you know, what the pattern that's been happening is, and I think we know this kind of, is every summer the ice starts melting like crazy, setting new records, dropping extremely fast, and everybody's thinking, okay, this is the year, this is the year. And then in August, there's a huge slowdown. In August, September, there's a really big slowdown. The melt rate of the ice drops, levels off, and we don't set a new record. And basically what's happening is there's a very strong ridge over the Arctic, so very, very clear skies, lots of melting early on in the summers. And then at the end of the summer, that pattern completely shifts. So there's almost like a trough situation over the Arctic, and it gets all cloudy. It cools down the atmosphere, the melt rate drops right off. And it turns out that she's related this in this paper. They related this to the spring snow cover melt, the loss of snow cover over the continent in the spring, which is setting records in the Arctic. And it's actually, we're talking about an area that's as large as the sea ice, essentially. Right. So we all talk about the Arctic loss of sea ice, but it's the snow cover, too, in the spring, which kind of sets the melt in the summer. And the jet stream ends up splitting so that there's a more northerly branch and a southerly branch. And this happens towards the end of the melt season in August. And this is related to this change of pressure over the Arctic from the high to the low and the clouding up and the slowing down of the sea ice. So it's definitely a strong negative feedback in place, which is kind of, you know, everybody builds up their sort of anticipation. This is the year. This is the year the ice is going. And then it doesn't happen for these reasons. It's getting a lot thinner, right? It's not just the extent that's important. It's really the volume of the ice, which depends on the thickness. So it's definitely, you know, it's on its way out. It's just a matter of time. I mean, years ago I said, you know, by 2023, it's probably a good bet that it's going to be gone. I would still hold with that because it's not reforming properly. You know, after this year's minimum, it took an awful long time for the ice to start freezing up. And there's still areas off Siberia and Laptev Sea and areas where the ice is just not forming the way it did before. If you look at the graph, its formation is a lot weaker. And this is because of the Atlantification effect, like the warm water, which is underneath the lens of fresh water in the Arctic Ocean. It's denser than the surface water, which is fresh and cold. And, you know, it's warmer and salty. So the density is higher, so it's underneath, and that's shoaling, that's coming to the surface, and that's preventing the ice being formed, you know, after the minimum.
Well, yes, for years you've been expecting to see this blue ocean event, to see a time when most of the ice in the Arctic would be gone, and it hasn't happened. And now we're finding through Jennifer Francis there's a possibility that a whole other cycle in the Arctic, the disappearance of the snow, is affecting the weather in September when the records should be set. So I have a suggestion here, Paul. I mean, look, during August, huge areas of the ocean were exposed to the sun. And in fact, in 2020, we were below the August record of 2012. So we have to figure that that means a lot more ocean was exposed to the sun. Maybe that's what matters. Maybe we need to change the point of measurement to the maximum difference in extent whenever that occurs, instead of just measuring in September. Or do I have something wrong there?
Yeah, no, because, what's really important is, you know, as we move into September, the angle of the sun is much, much lower, of course. You know, in the Arctic, we're heading towards 4 months of complete darkness in the Arctic. So actually, the level of ice extent is more important from the basis of a radiative standpoint in July and August, because the sun is, you know, the sun is much higher over the Arctic. So, you know, when a blue ocean event occurs and you do the calculation over the whole time period, there's going to be tremendous heating in the Arctic because that energy is not going to melting ice any longer. It'll be going to heating the surface of the ocean. But again, the ice levels in July and August are key. I mean, when we get to actually that blue ocean event with no ice in September, yes, there'll be more radiative heating, but the sun's already much lower on the horizon. So, there's a lot of different variables at play, but the net result is it's just a matter of time before we're going to see this happening. I mean, it's just difficult to predict. And Francis, that paper kind of shows, you know, their latest findings, their latest research, showing, you know, why the ice is hanging on a lot longer than one would expect, why we haven't set any new minimum since 2012. But, you know, that's only delaying things. That's not turning things around. I mean, it's on its way out, of course. I mean, we know that. It's just a matter of time. You know, I don't think it will be very long to have that extended, like no sea ice for, you know, a week in September, maybe in 2023, and then for a month or two, a few years later, and then year-round, certainly within a decade, maybe even sooner than that. I mean, we're definitely heading to, you know, a completely different Arctic, and we know what that does to the jet streams. I mean, not only will they become more broken and wavier and very chaotic and unpredictable, but their center of rotation is going to change completely. You know, it's going to be more over Greenland, more, you know, the center of Greenland is at 73 degrees north, which is a shift of 17 degrees latitude from the North Pole. So, you know, that's going to be the only cold place left. And for how long? I mean, that's, you know, the question. We're seeing extremely rapid melt rates on Greenland, also Antarctica as well. So, you know, and those are the things that affect sea level rise, of course.
Yes, we've got new science that says that what happens on one pole can affect the other pole. And this is a complicated situation, but I think that's really important to know. I'm just sort of searching here for where I had that paper that just came out.
Yeah, I mean, the clearest thing is that, when the sea level is rising from Greenland melt. Okay, so we have the blue ocean event, and we have a great acceleration of heating, you know, of the water, and that water is surrounding Greenland, really undercuts the ice there, and the melt rates on Greenland ramp up in order of magnitude, and then the sea level starts to ramp up much more quickly, and then the sea level, that tends to float that will, of course, extend over the whole oceans in the globe, you know, to not uniformly, right? We know the sea level rise, there's other effects that change the amount of sea level rise in different locations on the planet. But, you know, the rise will occur nonetheless in Antarctica. And that will, you know, a lot of the ice there is sitting on bedrock, right? The ice is very, very thick and it's extending down kilometers and sitting on the bedrock. So that will be lifted up slightly. And, you know, it's going to cause cascading failures of ice in the southern hemisphere as well. So, yeah, we're on this. We're in a very unstable climate situation, obviously.
Yeah, I found that article. It's titled "Antarctic Ice Dynamics Amplified by Northern Hemisphere Sea Level Forcing," published November 25th, 2020, in the journal Nature. Lead author Natalia Gomez, and so that's exactly what you're talking about. Is the interlocking? It's kind of really another case of the feedback effect. But I want to get in another thing here just to get across to listeners how crazy it has been in the north. Now, this heat hung up in Siberia in particular very long into what should be the deep, dark winter. Here's an article, November 23rd, 2020, by Jeff Bartarelli, and it says, according to the University of Maine's Climate Reanalyzer, this weekend the Arctic Circle was an average 12 degrees Fahrenheit above normal. This is not just one location, but the average of all 7.7 million square miles. That is a huge area, nearly double the size of the entire United States, being on average 12 degrees above normal, and that was in late November. That's big stuff. Do we know why that's happening? I mean, I've looked up at these climate reanalyzer maps, and you see great big red blobs of extra heat over eastern Siberia in particular, but also over the eastern Canadian Arctic. Is that just climate change? And why is it happening, Paul?
We've talked about this quite a bit over the years, right? You know, this Arctic temperature. Well, I mean, a lot of papers, they say Arctic amplification, but it's really it's Arctic temperature amplification. So, you know, the globe, average global temperatures, if they've increased, you know, say 1.1 degrees in the last 100 years, say, right, which is a common thing that you see. Well, the Arctic, it depends on how you define the Arctic. So if you're talking about north of 85 degrees, so the extremely high Arctic, that's warmed about 10 times faster than the global average. If you talk about north of, say, 70 degrees latitude, that's warmed about 5, 6, 7 times faster than the global average. And if you define the Arctic as north of 60 or north of, say, 66 degrees, which is commonly done, or if you take the 0-degree isotherm, so the average annual temperature 0 degrees, if you take that line around, circumvent the Earth with that on that isotherm, that's how some people define it, or the tree line, or, you know, where the permafrost really kicks in, then you get that number. It's more like 3 or 4 times faster. And often you see in articles on climate change, they say it's warming twice as fast. But, you know, that's been completely wrong, twice as fast. It's way faster than that. You know, those articles at least now are saying 2 to 3 times or 3 to 4 times. So they're getting closer to the truth. But it's really, you know, as you go further and further north, that warming is that much faster. And a lot of it is because the Arctic is, you know, it's a darkening place. It's no longer highly reflective. We have sensors called the so-called Ceres satellites, CERES, is Ceres instruments on satellites, and they show that the average reflectivity of the Arctic has changed, you know, 4, 5, 6%. So instead of reflecting 52% of incoming light, it now only reflects, say, it was down to 48, and then it was down to 46, 47. So, you know, it's getting a lot darker. It's just absorbing that much more solar energy and warming. But, you know, as much as it's warming, I mean, there's still a lot of snow and ice up there. That energy is going into melting that snow and ice. And when there's no snow and ice in regions like over the Arctic Ocean, it's going to become like the North Atlantic or North Pacific. It's you know, the water's going to warm extremely fast, and then it's never going to freeze in the winter. It just won't be able to freeze. There'll be too much energy stored up there. Normally in the ocean, you know, the Pacific, the Atlantic, there's an isocline, so the surface of the ocean is the warmest, and as you go deeper, there's a sharp drop-off in temperature. And there's thermoclines down 100 meters, 200 meters, and then you get very cold water. Well, right now the Arctic is coldest at the surface, and as you go down, it's getting warmer. So once the ice is gone, you'll no longer have that type of bathymetry. The whole Arctic will become like the Pacific and Atlantic. It'll become warmest at the surface and then colder as you go down. And then when it's warmer at the surface, there'll be a lot more interconnection of the water with the Pacific and the Atlantic side. And, you know, the heat just won't, you know, come the seasonal change and into the fall, there won't be enough coldness up there to freeze the water. It'll cool the ocean water, but then that'll be displaced by water coming up. Like, I think the ocean currents are going to completely shift up there. I mean, they have to with no ice. They are going to completely shift, and the thermocline is going to appear in the Arctic, like in the Pacific and Atlantic. And we're in a different totally different world there. And, of course, the biggest question is how are we going to grow food with all of these extreme weather events causing cascading crop failures simultaneous in different places of the world? I don't buy the idea that this is game over for humanity with no sea ice. I think that's an absurd idea. You know, I think it's going to be very, very, you know, we're going to be in a different world, and it's going to be extremely challenging to people and to countries and so on to grow enough food for their population. So that's going to change everything, all the geopolitics. If we think it's bad now, I think, you know, this is just a precursor. I mean, we know the virus is going to end. All viruses do. But, you know, abrupt climate change is not going to end. You know, the system is in motion and going to be very, very difficult to stop.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and I'm talking with our guest, Canadian scientist, climate scientist, Paul Beckwith. Okay, now you mentioned the changes in ocean currents.
I knew you were going to bring that up. Yes.
Yes, this is something a little bit different. We're not directly talking about currents per se, but we're talking about the whole circulation system in the ocean where things start off at the surface, go deep, go all the way south to the South Pole and come back up. And that whole thing is called, on the Atlantic side, it's called the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation. And very few people are familiar with that term, but we call it AMOC. And in 2015, I had a paper with a list of some of the best-known climate scientists in the West as far as the Arctic goes. We had Stefan Ramsdorf, Jason Box, and Michael Mann and more, published a paper in 2015. The title was Exceptional 20th Century Slowdown in Atlantic Ocean Overturning Circulation. It was published in Nature Climate Change. They said, okay, 15 to 20% slowdown is happening because of meltwater coming off of Greenland, and we can talk about the mechanics of how that works. But now, and I just sent you this last week, we have this new paper, mainly by scientists and institutions in South China, oceanographic institutions, who say, well, the title of the paper is A Stable Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation in a Changing North Atlantic Ocean Since the 1990s. And so they're saying, yeah, actually, it's pretty stable. Surprise.
It's pretty stable. Yeah, exactly. So I think we can expect this situation to occur quite a lot, I think, because, you know, we're talking about massive wrenching, you know, global scale changes, right? You know, one paper can say, oh, this is happening. And then another paper says, well, no, the opposite is happening. Well, what's going on? I mean, either one is right and the other one is wrong, or maybe, you know, they're done at different time periods, right? One's published 3 or 4 years ago, another one's published now. I mean, maybe things in the system are so unstable that they're actually changing on a timescale of, you know, of half a decade or something. I mean, we're seeing massive changes in the ice cover in the Arctic. We're seeing massive changes in the atmospheric circulation patterns in the Arctic, because when we have a high pressure covering the Arctic, which is what is occurring in the spring into the summer, and this is when you have a high pressure area, you have very few clouds, you have very stable weather, and this is perfect conditions. Also, the rotation of the whole system, the high pressure air is moving out from the Arctic to lower pressure areas. It deflects to the right in the northern hemisphere, so you get a clockwise rotation of this. It's like a huge anticyclone, if you like, over the Arctic, and that clockwise rotation tends to push ice out of the Fram Strait. So there's lots of export out of the Fram Strait. There's lots of export through the Canadian archipelago because we don't have thick ridged ice there. So that we get huge amounts of ice melt. And then what happens, as we know, and this has happened since 2012 in most summers, with the possible exception of the last year, 1919 and this year, is what happens is that high pressure gets displaced to a low pressure over the Arctic. So now the low pressure in the Arctic, that means more air is coming in from outside the Arctic and deflects to the right, so that causes a counterclockwise rotation. So the Fram ice export completely halts, and it's colder, and it's a lot more cloudier up there, so the ice melt completely slows down and halts. So now if you look at what happens to the ocean currents, right, I mean, the currents at the surface are very much dictated by the wind patterns, and then the currents down below are more established and harder to disrupt, but it's very complex. There's all kinds of different factors in play. So one study also is not enough in science. You need multiple studies, but generally you're talking about a stable system in when you're doing these multiple studies. So if you're measuring something in physics, somebody discovers something and then another paper backs it up, another one backs it up, and maybe a couple disagree. Eventually, you reach a consensus in the science that something is happening. But this is a system that we're trying to study that is always a moving target. It's always changing. It's not stable at all. So, you know, it's not really surprising that we're seeing some different results or different conclusions coming out of different studies. You know, if you consider what the end result will be, okay, so the end result will be, no sea ice forming year-round in the Arctic, right? The surface waters of the Arctic will be very, very warm and will never freeze in the winter. So, you know, there'll be a lot more interaction with the water coming in from both the Pacific and the Atlantic. I mean, maybe a completely new circulation system, at least on the surface currents, will occur, something that we haven't seen. And, you know, what will that do to the Gulf Stream then coming across and moving north? You know, instead of the water sinking to the bottom of the ocean, maybe it will just extend much further up into the Arctic, right? I mean, it's really a wild card. We really just, we just don't know for sure. But I haven't seen good models showing what we would expect, you know, when there's no Arctic sea ice year-round, because a lot of scientists, they don't want to think that that's the possibility. They think that there will always be ice up there in the winter, right? I mean, this is what I'm told time and time again. Well, okay, now the ice will disappear, you know, at the end of the melt season, but it's always going to regrow, I don't think that's the case at all.
Well, we know from previous studies of paleoclimatology that there have been long periods where there was no ice in the Arctic Sea. And in fact, it was almost tropical. We had crocodile bones found on Ellesmere Island and so on.
But the continents were in different places, right? When those paleo studies are, if they go back 50 million years ago, say to the Paleocene, Eocene thermal maximum, the location of the continents was actually quite different. So you can go back and look at where the continents were at those times when there was no ice in the Arctic and we had the crocodiles and turtles and all kinds of stuff. The temperature never dropped below freezing near in the marshes and so on, because those things wouldn't have survived, those creatures up there. And we had these huge megafauna as well. But you have to look at where the continents were then. So taking those temperatures from back then and putting them onto today's position of the continents, because they're not changing, of course, in the time scales we're talking about, and we're changing things much faster, then where are the models showing what we'll see, what the jet streams will look like, what the ocean patterns will look like? Like, I haven't seen any of that, so somebody will do it soon, I hope.
Yep, you're into literally uncharted territory for the future. Now, I should caution listeners that we're probably talking at least several hundred years, if not 1,000 years into the future, or are we?
No, I don't think so. Get ready to grow. I'm getting ready to grow pineapples in Ottawa, in maybe 10 years or something.
There may be crop changes. Me too. I've been looking at it. So look, I want to go back to something, though, that you just sort of mentioned, but I know that you've looked at extensively, and that is this. Look, a few years ago, North America and Europe were smashed with a cold wave that should have stayed in the Arctic. I know scientist Michael Mann asked, who left the fridge door open? So we can still get giant snow or ice storms or even bone-chilling cold even as the world is heating up. Is that possible?
Oh, well, exactly. As we as we're near the 0 degree transition point, right? Because, you know, if you're close to zero but slightly below, I mean, of course, warm air holds more moisture, more water vapor than cold air. So if the temperature over the land is, you know, in the minus 10, minus 20, then the air is very dry. It's not able to hold much water. But as it warms and gets closer and closer to zero, but is still below zero, then you can get these massive storms. And you need to look at the, you know, as long as the continents are slightly below zero on the coast and, you know, the oceans are so much warmer after a summer of heating that, you know, come the, you know, winter, you can get these massive nor'easter storms, for example, which are, you know, the air is laden with water. And then it cools as it comes over the land, which is a few degrees below zero, and you can get these massive, massive dumps of snow. And in some regions, and we're seeing this, we're seeing some of these huge storms on the East Coast in the early winter. We're also seeing a divided continent, a divided North America. Like right now, the temperature in Calgary, for example, was, I think, 14 degrees just yesterday, something like that. You know, we're a few degrees below zero in Ottawa, but basically the jet streams are such that the, you know, the western part of the country is warmer and, you know, warmer in the eastern part is a bit cooler. And meanwhile, if you look at Alaska, for example, they just had like record, they've never seen the rainfall that they had in the last few days. There's massive, massive rainfall in Alaska. You know, so we're getting lots more of these rainfall events rather than snowfall there. So, you know, it caused a landslide. It wiped out part of a village. There's like half a dozen people still missing from this village and stuff. And, you know, the roads were all and infrastructure was all destroyed. And, you know, I mean, but you can just look at the news and see this is happening, you know, all over the world, right? These type of events, because, you know, the jet streams are just so fractured and broken. You know, we're getting huge increases in extreme weather events, whether it be massive torrential rains leading to floods or droughts, you know, heat waves and droughts, and they're going on for long periods of time. So they're increasing in frequency, severity, and duration, right? I mean, we're just seeing all of these effects from the situation.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking with Paul Beckwith, the Canadian climate scientist, and we've got a pretty big range of things we're going to cover here. And one of them, Paul, is I'm getting conflicting news about the CO2 that's going into the atmosphere due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Some sources say, well, yeah, it's been cut by 40%, and we've had a huge reduction because people are staying home and they're not going out on cruise ships and there's fewer flights and all of that. But on November 23rd, the World Meteorological Organization, part of the United Nations, said that, yes, there has been a drop, but it's just a drop in our increase. We're still increasing the amount of greenhouse gases going into the atmosphere. And they say any impact on CO2 concentrations is, in fact, no bigger than the normal year-to-year fluctuations in the carbon cycle and the high natural variability anyway. So we haven't managed to slash enough carbon, according to them, to really make a difference to the climate. What are you hearing, Paul?
Yes, I mean, I've seen numbers like, you know, reduction. I don't know what the latest is on the virus impacts on global CO2 emissions, but I've seen numbers about, I've seen that that the numbers are about, you know, maybe 8 or 9% lower than they would be without a virus. Yeah, I mean, it's like the old, you know, you're filling a bathtub, right? And the drain is quite small, so not much of the CO2 is the water going into the bathtub, basically, the analogy. And, you know, the taps were wide open, the drain was clogged, so the level of CO2 in the atmosphere, which is the water level in the bathtub, is rising and rising and rising. you know, and now we slow down the tap a little bit, but it's still there. It's still running. There's still water coming out of the tap. So the level is rising, but slower than it would have otherwise. I mean, this is where we get into talks about, you know, we have to actually remove CO2 from the atmosphere. You know, we can talk a little bit about what we can do about, you know, what I think the best ideas are to address some of these, you know, runaway, accelerating climate system change problems that we're having, because it's going to hit our food supply very, very soon. I'm doing a whole series of videos after we get off the phone. I'm going to start filming a whole bunch of videos on how today our global food supply is being severely affected. Now, this isn't a future thing. It's happening right now, today. I mean, it's severely affected by what's happening. And there's nothing that, you know, we all have to eat, right? So this is a huge deal for the planet. I think this is a, sort of the weak point of humanity in dealing with abrupt climate change. It's going to be the ability to grow food and, you know, feed ourselves.
Where do we go to find those videos, Paul?
If you go to paulbeckwith.net, that's my blog, will be posted up there, links to them. Or if you just go to, the best thing is just go on YouTube and search for my name, Paul Beckwith Climate, and just subscribe to my YouTube channel and subscribe to my blog as well. I mean, there's additional information that's given at my blog when I do the videos. But, you know, years ago, and I've been doing these videos for years, and years ago, I could pick the most important topic, sort of, and, you know, do a couple videos a week discussing those. But now, I mean, I could do multiple videos every day on the important topics that are going on. There's just so much happening. The system is just, you know, it's exponentially changing, right? People really don't understand exponential growth.
Well, I've been calling for a climate cable channel, because we're not getting this. We're getting the U.S. political situation. People around the world are watching that debacle, and we're getting quite a bit about COVID. But meanwhile, serious things are happening, as we were discussing in the Arctic and all over the place, and it's not getting out through the media. Now, you talked about possible solutions. I want to tell you one that isn't a solution, and this is, to me, a scary story. I read it in The Guardian on December 2nd. It said, "World is doubling down on fossil fuels despite the climate crisis," a UN report says. Production has to fall by 6% a year to avoid severe climate disruption. But COVID-19 funding is supporting increases. So the world governments are planning, as a way to come back out of the economic crisis, to produce even more coal, oil, and gas, to build everything back up the way it was instead of switching to renewables. And that's just a recipe for disaster. You know, if you can borrow $1 trillion in the United States or billions in Canada and pour it into your fossil fuel industry, oh my God.
Yeah, I know. It's just almost like a lot of these companies see that the writing is on the wall, so they want to develop all of their resources and assets with fossil fuels as quickly as possible before there's laws and, you know, the world is completely against them doing that, right? So it's crazy. It's like a stampede to make that last buck on the fossil fuels in the ground in your particular site before you can't do it any longer. So with everybody having the same mindset, it's like total chaos. Yeah, we live in a highly illogical world. You know, we're doing things as, there's no thought for the future. There's no thought at all.
Anti-logic world. And then getting back to your work in the Arctic, we have another new paper published November 12, 2020. The title is, "An Earth System Model Shows Self-Sustaining Melting of Permafrost, Even If All Man-Made Greenhouse Gas Emissions Stop in 2020. So that seems to say that the world is already past a point of no return for global warming. Do you agree with that?
I don't agree with it, because we're not helpless. Like, we can actually, if we have smart people in charge, and if we follow the best science, and if we get engineers to, instead of working on military budgets, you know, if we take that the U.S. military budget, for example, and put it on addressing, ramping up renewables and finding solutions to pull carbon out of the atmosphere and to block some sunlight hitting the earth, then we have a shot at turning things around. So you know, without that, then, yeah, I mean, we're just, you know, it's just going to get worse and worse. So, you know, a couple of the things, I'll just throw them out there. People can look them up because I will be doing videos on them in the near future. And things like ISA, iron salt aerosols. Okay, so the idea of this is you put iron salts into the atmosphere, and these aerosols, one thing they do is they attack methane, and they get rid of methane in the atmosphere in the region where they are. Another thing that they do is they create low-level clouds, which block some of the sunlight and causes cooling. And another thing that they do is the when they go into the ocean, when the aerosols come out of the air, the iron in the salt actually stimulates phytoplankton blooms in the ocean, which pulls CO2 out of the atmosphere. So these things are very, you know, very low risk for causing harm, and they have a lot of positive features. Another idea, there's a paper I'll discuss that just came out, which talks about using enhanced weathering with things like olivine, which is a mineral, and it pulls CO2. You can basically, as you, there's in Iceland, they pumped CO2 underground and it formed into rock within, you know, a very extremely fast time frame, like less than a year. It was creating rock deep under the ground. Well, you know, enhanced weathering with this olivine could possibly pull out maybe a third of our global, you know, what we're presently emitting into the atmosphere each year. About a third of that could be possibly removed by this technique, and it seems like the scalability is possible. There's some research on just looking at new materials that radiate a lot more energy out to space than existing materials. So that's a bit technical to explain right now, but the idea of having, you know, this type of thing on your roof where it's radiating huge amounts of radiation up into space because it's of the particular wavelength which goes through the atmosphere. So a lot of you're radiating energy up to space, which is in the atmospheric window, if you like, the window where it won't be absorbed by the air in the atmosphere. And I've always been interested in the space program. And, you know, I look at what Elon Musk is doing. They're actually doing a test with their Starship, they call it. I mean, this is he's dead set on sending humans to Mars by 2026, like in the next 4 to 6 years. And he's talking his the size of and scale of this thing can support, can hold about 100 people. You know, they're doing amazing tests. Now, okay, so what? How does that relate? Well, for a long time, there's been an idea that if we put up some screen, if you like, umbrella over part of the Earth, in orbit, we could block, change the tilt of this thing and block some of the sunlight. So we're talking about, we'd have to have, you know, many hundreds of square miles probably of this thing. And there's been lots of technologies with mylar sheets, like extremely thin mylar. It's highly reflective. You know, if we put it up into orbit and it was in an orbit such that it was staying between the Earth and the sun, so it wouldn't be geosynchronous, right? Because then if it was in geosynchronous, its position over the Earth wouldn't change, and the Earth is rotating. So, you know, it would only be functioning when it was between the Earth and the sun, right, to block the sunlight. But if we had it in an orbit so that it stayed always between the sun and the Earth is rotating underneath, then we could block a small amount of sunlight and buy us time to slash emissions and to pull CO2 out of the atmosphere and to retool and do all of these other things. You know, I've talked about the idea of sulfur dioxide in the atmosphere, you know, from volcanoes. We know that cools the planet, right? But then that can cause other issues. So there's all of these different technologies, and we're hardly spending any money to study them. Right, because we're spending all that money, and the engineers and scientists with the know-how are working on ways to kill people on the Earth. They're working on military budgets.
And they're working on opening up the Arctic Wildlife Preserve to more fossil fuel drilling. That's what Trump is trying to do. And although the price of oil is so low now, and the oil companies are they're not bankrupt, but they're hurting and they're shutting down a lot of their expansion just because of economic reasons. That could change if we get a sudden burst after the vaccine. But at the same time, I just interviewed Dr. Pierre Verlinden from Australia, a solar expert who worked with a great big solar company in China making panels. And he says it's already cheaper not just to make new solar farms rather than make new gas plants to make electricity. It's cheaper to install solar now than it is to operate those old plants. So there's also hope, I think, on the front of just turning down the water into the bathtub that you were talking about to cut our emissions.
Yeah. You know, I've hesitated on this, the idea of this sunshade thing. I mean, it sounds too sci-fi. It sounds like it's incredibly complex. It would be super expensive. But I don't know. I mean, in following the SpaceX technologies, you know, these rockets, they land them back on the little barge in the ocean. And if you watch some of that stuff, I mean, that's like super high sci-fi type stuff, right? And they're doing this test to 15 kilometers with this massive thing they call the Starship, which will eventually be heading to Mars. And they've had some short hops of this thing. And they, you know, Elon Musk himself says that the chance of this thing test succeeding on the weekend is about 1 in 3, you know, what they're doing. But if you look at that, some of that stuff, and if you read the biography on Musk and some of his objectives, I mean, the Tesla car, you know, I mean, he just wants to hedge humanity's bets. He says, you know, the chances of us destroying ourselves on this planet it's not looking very good for the human race right now. So he wants to hedge bets and have colonies start up on Mars. I mean, I sort of have always wondered, well, why wouldn't the moon be done first and then use the moon as a hopping point for Mars? But, you know, it seems really crazy and stuff, the idea of solar shades, but the launch capability to put these things in orbit is basically, we have it now.
We just had an interview on Radio EcoShock done by Brent Ragsdale of Ye Tao, who has worked out of Harvard to develop reflective material. He calls it mirror reflection on the Earth that would reflect more of the sun's. We're sort of mimicking what the ice was supposed to do or used to do, but now we can do it in everything we build, from our roads to our buildings, and even replace some of the grains of sand on our beach with more reflective material. So I think, Paul, what we're coming down to is a situation very similar to where we are in the pandemic. In the pandemic, we have to say to people, for the next few months, you really have to stay home if you can. And if you have to go out, just totally protect yourself and only go out as necessary. But help could be on the way with a vaccine that could get us back to a better life. And I think we're sort of like that in climate now. We have to say to people, okay, even if you get this vaccine, don't sign up for that dream cruise ship that you had in mind. And don't buy all the stuff you don't need and go shopping and fill your house with stuff that you're going to send to the dump. Because we have to hang down on emissions now until we can get some of these better ideas that scientists are working on and fund even more of them, as you say, until we get stuff that works that can make it we have a sustainable life on Earth for ourselves, for our kids, for our grandkids. But we've got to hang down in our carbon emissions and stay home until we get ways of living better.
Radio EcoShock.
Right, exactly. Like, it's sort of like short-term pain for long-term gain, right? And long-term survival, really.
Exactly.
Right? I mean, that's what we're really talking about. But like I say, the sunshade thing, you know, it blows me away, the technological things that SpaceX and Musk and what they're doing and their launch capability and the price. And, you know, lots of people are saying that they're actually absurd. It's just, here's just a billionaire who's looking for a route for other billionaires to get away off the Earth. I mean, you know, and he should be spending his billions for, you know, these engineers to find climate solutions, for example, right? I mean, that's what some people argue. I mean, I do listen to all sides of these arguments, but I mean, the technology, the engineer in me is just, you know, blown away by what they've been doing and what they're continuing to do. And I'm thinking, okay, well, just take one of those rockets one of those star craft and fill it with rolls of Mylar, you know, and, you know, then deploy it, you know, keep going, heading out instead of burn your rockets longer, go up to the orbit where, you know, and get the orbital speed and start deploying these rolls of Mylar. And there you go. I mean,
No, I don't know, Paul. You're kind of scaring me here because, look, that could very well change parts of weather in the world, and it certainly will reduce the amount of sunlight reaching the Earth, and we need that sunlight for the crops to feed the billions of people we've got, and we need it for our solar power. I mean, what about that? I mean, we would reduce solar power.
The point is, you know, it's such a tiny fraction of the incoming sunlight. That would be, I mean, we're talking about the reduction of, you know, if you look at the solar constant, right, the amount of the top of the atmosphere solar radiation, say it's like 1369 watts per square meter or whatever that number is, right? I mean, we're talking about reducing, you know, the additional radiation on the surface of the Earth from climate. It's like, you know, little tiny Christmas light bulbs, if you like. I mean, an extra couple watts per square meter, right? So we're talking about a very, very small fraction of a percent reduction in the incoming light, which is it's no different from, you know, you can put reflectors on the surface of the Earth, right? They're only going to operate for a small fraction of the 24-hour day, right? They're only going to operate when the sun is shining. Right. If you put them up in orbit, they're operating 24/7 and they're cutting back such a small amount, minuscule amount of light. Right. They're, you know, whether you put them there or on the surface of the Earth or whether you use sulfur in the upper atmosphere, in the stratosphere, right, to block a little bit of sunlight. I mean, we know we kind of can model all of these things from what's happened with these large volcanoes that we have. Right. And the amount of, you know, the cooling, you know, large volcano goes off.
Would the amount that we're going to cut off, let's say we put out a mirror in space, you say it's a very small amount in watts per square meter, would it be less than what we're already blocking with the smog that covers large parts of China and India and North America?
I think it would be comparable to what we're blocking, but it would be over the globe. It wouldn't be just, you know, over a continent or something. Right. So because it's over the globe, you can have even a smaller effect over the whole planet. Right. But
well, I'll tell you, you're still making me nervous with this talk, but I know that we're in a desperate situation and we've got to consider a lot of things. As we start to wrap up here, Paul, is there other science that you would like to talk about or things that you're planning for your upcoming videos or even recent videos that you think people should know about?
As I mentioned, there's a lot of really interesting technologies that may be possible. Now, I know lots of people are against the idea of technologies, right? Because they've got us into this huge problem, right? And it seems that whenever we come out with the technology that solves one problem, it creates an even larger problem. But I guess in response to that is, you know, the only reason I'm bringing that up is because I don't think that there's too much other choice. I mean, we're clearly not going to cut emissions to zero overnight. And even if we did cut them overnight, you know, we have papers that are saying that the permafrost thaw is well underway and we've passed the point of no return like 50 years ago on that. So long term, we're still going to get huge amounts of warming. I mean, you know, we are intelligent individuals. We can develop technologies and stuff but we don't have any long-term thinking, really. And our whole models are geared for making money. And, you know, we don't think about, like, I don't know, if you read some of the philosophers about technology, I think you really need to get into that sort of thing. Like Jacques Ellul, the Technological Society. I mean, technologies kind of feed on themselves, right? So I can see why there's, you know, why people are against that. I mean, I you know, sure, disagree with me. I mean, I encourage that. I mean, I'm saying, like, from my seat, I mean, I see abrupt climate change. I see the acceleration. I see how it's going to take out our food supply in a short period of time. And I say, okay, well, I'm not just going to throw up my hand. So, you know, what the heck could we do about this? And, you know, I start looking at some of these technologies and I say, okay, if we can deploy these things you know, we can buy ourselves more time. But it all comes down to a complete change of human thought of who we are on this planet. And, you know, do we want to continue to stay on this planet and live on this planet and have any life left on this planet, right? It really comes down to a lot of philosophical things. And, you know, if the answer to that is yes, you know, we've got to do everything possible we can, then those are the things I that's why I start talking about these different technological ideas, right? It's just kind of like, okay, we're in the soup so much. But, you know, if people don't understand the severity of where we are right now, how, you know, we're going to lose our food supply, there's going to be mass starvation, there's going to be a push to nationalism and right-wing government. You know, that's a horrible human feedback of abrupt climate change. Stressing resources, right? It's this push. I mean, is democracy even going to survive? I mean, that if I said that a few years ago, people would have laughed. But, you know, with the after 4 years of Trump, you know, and what's going on now, I mean, that's not such a, you know, that's a very valid question. You know, is democracy resilient enough to survive? I mean, we're not doing very well right now, right? Yeah, it's there's always something new happening. I mean, I don't know if you, I haven't had a chance to see Stuart Scott just interviewed Peter Wadhams, you know, about the Arctic and did a video. That's the Facing Future. You just Google Facing Future. Okay. There's I haven't seen it. It was just released a couple days ago, and there was there's been a couple interviews with Peter Carter. You know, one of them I just thought, you know, posted today, and I haven't had a chance to watch that either. I mean, I don't, who has time to watch all of this stuff, but I try to, you know, not miss anything from Bottoms or Peter Carter. You know, we're hoping to all get to, you know, all present and get together and do stuff at the next COP. I mean, we were planning to do that this year, but of course, you know, that didn't happen. Hopefully, you know, it goes on in Edinburgh in 2021, and, you know, we're all planning to do stuff there. So, I think as long as, I've said, you know, as long as there's a few hundred humans parked at the, you know, pole or something, and everybody else is gone, they'll still be trying to think of solutions and surviving and bailing ourselves out, right? So, you know, that's who we are, right? In the meantime, don't spend all of your time thinking about these things, right? You, like, start reading some Stephen King's and...
Are we all resilient enough to survive? I think that's the open question, but I always enjoy talking with you, Paul, precisely because you haven't bought into the diseases of despair. You are, like, to me, one of those doctors in the COVID wards who goes from one patient who may have died or is in deep trouble to the next patient because they still hope to save as many as they can. And I think that's where we are now with humanity. We hope to save as many as we can, and we hope to provide a good life for everyone, and there must be a way. I think we're smart enough to find the way, and we just have to give it a shot. We've been talking with Paul Beckwith at the University of Ottawa. I'm sorry, Paul, we're out of time. And I encourage everybody to go to paulbeckwith.net. My way of getting to Paul is I go to YouTube and I just search for Paul Beckwith Climate, and you get his channel, you click on his channel, you go through the videos, you start learning at the university level, but explained for everybody. You don't have to be a scientist. What is happening with our world and some of the things that we can do with it. And we get it from some of the top scientists being interpreted by a good teacher, Paul Beckwith. Thank you so much for being on the show again, Paul.
Well, thank you, Alex. I guess it was a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Please pass this program on to your friends. Get it free at ecoshock.org. And join me again next week.
In this series, we have heard technological solutions for capturing carbon. But there are other ways to help nature heal the atmosphere. In 2019, Thomas Crowther from ETH Zurich explained how planting billions more trees can reduce carbon dioxide in the air. Other guests showed ways to capture carbon with better farming techniques. Overseas, natural farming is booming in India to help the climate.
Meanwhile, deep human changes like low-meat diets, voluntary simplicity and choosing a low-carbon life can alter the atmosphere and protect lives in the future. We cover it all on Radio EcoShock. Thank you for listening.